Austerity runs smack into democracy in Europe.
Is financial stability in Europe about to become French toast?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org for Monday, April 23rd.
Coming up, big primary elections in the Northeast. But what does Occupy Wall Street have to say?
And Walmart and bribery in Mexico.
Plus a puzzling prediction about toy profits.
Just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
France is one step closer to replacing its conservative president with a socialist one. Incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy came in second yesterday to socialist François Hollande in the first round of voting. The two candidates will face a runoff on May 6th, and the ultimate outcome could have big consequences for Europe's debt crisis. The BBC's Hugh Schofield joins us now from Paris with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we've been reporting that if Sarkozy ends up losing and France goes over to a socialist leader, that it might call into question some of the agreements that have been reached to deal with Europe's debt crisis and that Europe may go back into crisis mode. What's the word on the street about that today?
Well, I mean, it would certainly be irresponsible to say that if Hollande gets elected, it will switch straight back into crisis mode. In terms of there being an immediate problem or France's rating being downgraded if Hollande gets in, I very much doubt that. But they will be looking for signals over the future weeks and months of an Hollande victory to see what kind of message he's sending about getting France's finances in order.
Now, the term socialist gets thrown around all the time in this country. When you hear about a socialist candidate in France, are we to assume that person is pro-government all the way, anti-business even?
No, I don't think one could say that. I mean, the modern socialist party in France is realistic. I mean, it works in the real world. I mean, it is constantly being attacked by its left wing and for having sold out to the forces of capitalism and so on. Yes, he will want to balance the books by putting up taxes on the very wealthy. And the problem is that what the markets and what economists are saying is needed in France is radical reform of labour markets. And that is really much less likely to happen under Hollande than under Sarkozy, even though one has to say even under Sarkozy, not that much has happened in that direction either.
The BBC's Hugh Schofield in Paris. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now to some serious accusations about the world's largest retailer. The New York Times reports that Walmart's Mexican subsidiary paid millions of dollars in bribes in order to put its stores all over Mexico. And the Times says Walmart's top executives knew about it. Walmart says it's investigating, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Times says Walmart paid out more than $24 million in bribes. According to the report, the money went to local officials in Mexico. Months or even days after the alleged payments, zoning permits for new stores appeared, and bureaucratic barriers melted away. Walmart didn't tell the Justice Department about the reported bribes until after being contacted by the Times. Mike Kaler teaches business law at Butler University. He's an expert on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which makes it illegal for U.S. companies to bribe foreign officials. Kaler says federal investigators could use that law to expand their probe.
They will be curious as to whether the conduct was isolated or whether this is how Walmart obtained foreign licenses and permits all over the world.
Kaler says Walmart will now have to spend millions of dollars more on its own bribery investigation, which could take years. But eventually, Kaler expects Walmart to settle with the Justice Department. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
For more on the state of Walmart in Mexico in the wake of this Times piece, we've got Charles Fishman on the line. He's the author of the book The Walmart Effect and happens to reside these days in Mexico City. He's here with us for today's Midday Extra. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
Well, what's your reaction to this Times piece?
Well, my first reaction is that it's an extraordinary piece of investigative journalism. The Times did a spectacular job. The second reaction you have to have if you pay any attention to Walmart is that it's really not just an appalling accounting of corruption, but Walmart is the company that wouldn't take a can of diet soda or a dinner or a golf match from any vendor. They wouldn't join trade associations because of having to pay dues and hang out with competitors and have the potential for conflict of interest. And so Sam imposed this incredible code of ethical conduct. And for most of Walmart's history, Walmart will be 50 this summer, you could say that they were a brutal competitor, but everybody agreed that they were an ethical competitor. And here is their signature overseas division. The first store outside the U.S. was in Mexico. It has always been held up as the shining example of spectacular growth and performance. And it turns out they rigged the game systematically.
Now, Charles, you're noting the irony here, but are you surprised?
I am surprised at the routine nature of the alleged bribery. I mean, the one period for which they give numbers, Walmart was paying 3 bribes a week in Mexico every week for 3 years. And that's just the period that the New York Times learned about. So it was just Walmart's way of doing business in Mexico. It's not making a huge splash in Mexico because there is a degree to which even in ordinary life, ordinary people pay, you know, small amounts of money to get done what they need to get done just to move things along.
Does it seem like the kind of thing that Walmart had to do, or are they going to look back on this and say, why in the world did we have this person or these people, handing out bribes to expand in Mexico? We could have done it without doing that.
The account that's in the Times makes it seem like Walmart didn't get anything that they wouldn't have otherwise ultimately gotten. But there's a line in there from the Walmart lawyer who revealed all this to the New York Times, who says, what we were buying was time. When you step into the world of retail in Mexico and in Mexico City, Walmart is just dominant. There's a Walmart 105 steps from our house in one direction, and there's another one 6 blocks from our house in the other direction.
Wow.
And if we wanted to shop somewhere else, we would actually have a difficult time. And so they dominate what's called organized retail, and they have outmaneuvered all of their Mexican competitors. The general thinking was it's simply their incredible focus and discipline. In the last 3 years, they have opened 5 stores a week in 2009 and 2010. They opened 260 stores a year. Last year, they opened a store every day in Mexico. That's how you flood the zone and dominate the market. And so I think it has been tremendously helpful. They're the largest company of any kind in Mexico.
Now, we've been focusing in this conversation on the bribery part of this, but another key section of the Times reporting is about the, I guess we have to use the phrase cover-up here on the part of some senior Walmart executives. No one seemed to be overeager about sharing the results of an internal Walmart investigation with the Mexican government, the U.S. government, or the wider world.
Yeah, I think there are 2 elements of this that are quite discouraging. One is the routine practice. I think the people in Mexico, just to put a coda on that, might say, how is that different from American companies hiring good zoning lawyers? You know, there might be a little bit of the sort of shrug in Mexico because it's the way of doing business. It's clearly illegal, both in Mexico and in the U.S., to pay government officials to get done what you need to get done, even if it would get done anyway. The equally discouraging and in some ways the potentially much more damaging and distracting part of this is that former CEO Lee Scott, current CEO Mike Duke, who was in charge of all international operations when this came to light, and a whole series of officials at the next level down, the New York Times reporting implicates all these folks as knowing and resolving the quote-unquote scandal or the investigation back in 2006 by sending it back to Mexico to be resolved, which is a little bit like letting the accused embezzler or pyramid scheme operator investigate him or herself.
Charles, finally, you spent a lot of time learning everything that there could possibly be to know about this company, Walmart. What kind of implications do you think something like this will have on the company?
I've been a little surprised that this hasn't sort of blown up the way, you know, some stories about Walmart go viral, locking employees in the store overnight, which was something they clearly did for a while. I think this could be very, very damaging to Walmart long term, because now the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorneys, are going to ask not just how do you do business in Mexico, but how do you do business in China? How do you do business in the rest of Latin America? And so at the very least, it's going to require millions and millions of dollars and the time of many talented people to answer those questions. And you know, Walmart could end up having to pull back the curtain on a lot of what, you know, on a lot of how it does business. And I think at the very least, that's going to be hugely distracting from running the company. And at the worst, we could be hearing the beginning rather than the end of this set of problems.
We've been talking via Skype with Charles Fishman, author of The Walmart Effect. He lives in Mexico City. Mr. Fishman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
New York will hold its presidential primary tomorrow, along with four other states. Not a lot of political suspense in the Empire State for either party, but both parties have been mining that state for cash. As part of our coverage of the real economy, what matters most in this election, Marketplace's David Gura visited two zip codes in Manhattan, which have donated the most political money of any two neighborhoods in the country, just to opposite candidates.
Jeff Gorel is a real estate executive who's been on the Upper West Side for more than 20 years now.
You've got the park, and you've got shopping on Columbus, Amsterdam, Broadway. It's near Zabar's. Terrific place to live.
Gorel is a millionaire who could live anywhere in Manhattan. And he's picked the El Dorado on Central Park West.
You know, you can go to any restaurant without getting dressed up, which is important for me because I like to be casual. If you live on the East Side, you have to put a jacket and tie on to go to a restaurant.
Breakfast is at the Popover Cafe just six blocks away. Gorel orders a couple of fried eggs, a glass of apple juice, and he tells me the Upper West Side is a comfortable place for Democrats like him. And the stats back that up. So far, Gorel and his neighbors in zip code 10024 have donated more than $500,000 to President Obama's reelection campaign. That's more than any other zip code in the U.S.
People have to get elected, and it costs money to run TV commercials, and that's the system.
And New York City is an important part of that system. Campaigns mine the corporate sector for cash. Another day, another diner, another donor. I'm at Nectar Restaurant on the Upper East Side on Madison Avenue with Andy Busser. He's an investor with an apartment in zip code 10021. It's about a mile away from Jeff Gorel's place, as the pigeon flies. And it's a part of Manhattan that's home to a lot of
lawyers. it's a lot of people in financial services, I think.
Busser and his neighbors have given more than $500,000 to Mitt Romney's campaign.
But there's a lot of money in this zip code. It is a wealthy zip code.
With a lot of well-heeled executives who have backed the presumptive Republican nominee.
It doesn't surprise me that there are more Romney supporters here than perhaps on the Upper West Side.
Both candidates are counting on more donations from these two neighborhoods. So this war for campaign contributions being waged on opposite sides of Central Park's Great Lawn has just begun. In New York, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
With the primary season in full swing, one question arises. Where is Occupy Wall Street in any of this? The movement, which erupted here in Manhattan late last summer, has spawned some candidates, including one running in Pennsylvania tomorrow. Let's go out now and learn more about what some see as a logical next step for Occupy Wall Street.
It's going to be hot today.
First things first. Nathan Kleinman is running for Congress in Pennsylvania as a Democrat, not Green Party, not Independent, Democrat capital D. But in January, when Kleinman announced he was going up against his hometown Democratic Representative Allison Schwartz, a friend passed the word along to the online news site Politico.
The very next day, they had this story, the first Occupy candidate. And when I saw that, I smirked a little bit and thought this is going to be a different campaign than I expected.
Kleinman spent a lot of his time down at Occupy Philly last fall, and now as a congressional candidate has spent these past few months doing the political candidate thing. Town meetings, knocking on doors.
Hey, Mike.
Hi, Nate. How you doing?
Hey, I'm Nate.
And fundraising. Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's donated $2,012. But even in the weeks leading up to the election, he's still devoted to Occupy. Last week, Kleinman taught a course for Occupy's Free University of Philadelphia.
This is the introduction to a book called The First American Revolution. The American Revolution did not start with the shot heard round the world on the morning
Kleinman's
of
Kleinman's one of a handful of people coming out of the Occupy movement who are deciding to take part in electoral politics, including candidates in South Carolina and Illinois. UC Berkeley political scientist Paul Pearson says the movement should embrace the development.
The ballot box has to be part of it. The people who are making the laws, they need to know what the consequences for them politically are going to be, depending on the positions that they take.
But electoral politics can be tricky. Kleinman opted to become a write-in candidate when there was a legal challenge to the signatures that got him on the ballot. That's quite a hurdle, and even in his free university class, some are skeptical. Can you really occupy Congress?
I've seen people get elected and all their promises disappear once they get there, and it's not about you, Nate. It's not about you.
Some say part of the problem with running for office is that the system itself is broken. Tammy Shapiro is an organizer with Occupy in New York.
When you run for electoral politics, you have to run and be a part of that system. And once you're a part of that system, it's really difficult to make huge impacts.
But she says that doesn't mean forgetting electoral politics.
I think the power and the strength of the Occupy movement is that there's people who take different approaches to the same problems. And it's those different approaches that are going to get us somewhere.
Kleinman agrees wholeheartedly. After he got dubbed the nation's first Occupy candidate, Occupy Philly crafted a statement saying it does not endorse candidates.
I stood there and I supported that proposal. Ultimately, people decided that it should be short and it should just be, we are a nonpartisan movement, we do not support candidates. But I supported not supporting myself, believe it or not.
Nathan Kleinman, write-in candidate for Congress in Pennsylvania and an Occupy Philly activist.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Later today, we get results of the latest checkup on the finances of Medicare and Social Security. Trustees of the two massive programs release their annual reports. Last year, the headline was that both could be closer to insolvency than previously thought. From Washington, Elizabeth Wynne Johnson reports on what to look at as these updates get released into a campaign season.
The Social Security and Medicare trustees reports are always part reality check, part invitation for politicians to spin the party line. Monique Morrissey is with the Economic Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. This year, she says,
we're bracing ourselves for probably a slightly negative report compared to last year's, only because the economy is still not doing very well.
That affects how much tax revenue comes in. For Social Security and Medicare, the crucial question is how long the trust funds can continue to cover all the benefits. Economist Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution doesn't expect a big change in the estimate for when the funds would run out.
But if there's a movement of even 1 year, I think you can anticipate that people who are running for office and who have an axe to grind are going to try to make something out of it.
In the meantime, be on the lookout for changes in the underlying assumptions, like how immigration factors into the entitlement equation. In Washington, I'm Elizabeth Wynne Johnson for Marketplace.
The toy and game maker Hasbro said this morning it lost more than $2 million last quarter, compared with a $17 million profit in the same period a year ago. As our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, when you're losing the game, you can always try changing the rules.
Hasbro executives hope to breathe new life into their most popular brands with a fresh take, for example, on playing Monopoly. The company's marketing chief, John Frascati, talked about it at a recent Toy Fair presentation.
Our consumer research told us that people want to play Monopoly faster. So this year we're introducing Monopoly Millionaire, where the first person to accumulate $1 million wins the game.
It's a focus on a new set of three R's: reimagine, reinvent, reignite. A new version of the company's game of life lets players use an iPad's touchscreen as a high-tech spinner and then watch a video to see the results of their life decision.
We're introducing several new gaming innovations this year that'll feature this convergence of analog and digital play. And clearly, these are not your typical board games.
While Hasbro's board game business has lagged, it reports selling more than 13 million digital games last year for play on the iPhone and iPad. It's also banking on the sale of rights to movies based on popular board games like Battleship, which is already top box office charts in Europe and is due for U.S. release next month. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There's a new light bulb on sale this morning for the low, low price of $60. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tung has the story.
It's the Rolls-Royce of LEDs, the light bulb for the 1%. Send in your best joke. But first, let's look under the hood. The Philips 60-watt LED is a same-size, same-shape replacement for your old-school incandescent. It sips 1/6 the energy and gets sky-high government ratings for quality of light. Martine Simard-Normandine is with Mew Analysis in Ottawa.
For reading lamps, it's rather nice, actually, because you like to have the light close to you on your book. With a LED light bulb, there's no heat.
The new bulb can dim, which may also describe its sales potential. Who's going to buy this?
People like me were very, very curious. Will buy it, but it's rather expensive, isn't it?
Philips claims the bulb saves $8 a year in energy costs, and the bulb is made to last 20 years, so you can do the math. And for now, the maker is knocking off $10, so it's down to just 50. Not an early adopter? Sit back. Seymour Normandin says in a couple years, prices will plummet. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now, when we speak, Jeremy, who really listens? You know, and there's a reason for that. It's because our name is not E.F. Hutton. Hmm. The Wall Street Journal reports today that name is coming back from the dead in the form of a boutique financial advisory group to be run by a former E.F. Hutton guy. If you look at corporate genealogy, most of the old firm is now part of Citigroup. E.F. Hutton used to run those TV ads all the time suggesting their whispered investment info was so awesome that whole rooms, if not entire stadiums, would go silent as people pricked up their ears to listen in.
Well, and while we're pricking up our ears to listen in, listen to this. Remember Scrooge McDuck, David, the cartoon character who was famous for swimming through his private vault of gold coins?
Oh, right, in that giant vault, right.
Yes, exactly. Well, a guy named Matt Powers at the website The Billfold did what I'm sure millions of people were waiting to find out about, which is he spent time calculating just how much gold is in that vault. And he figured out that if the gold is about 5 feet deep and the average duck is 14 inches tall, then Scrooge has somewhere between $31 and $210 billion. So there you go. Now you have the answers.
He spent time calculating that. Well, great.
It's actually much more complicated than that. He's figured out that if one pile is this high and one pile is this high and the room is a certain size on TV, then it must be a little bit bigger. It's very complicated. It's got all kinds of square roots and stuff. But anyway.
Wow. Okay. Glad he did it.
The Billfold. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.